Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back from your lunch break. I hope you had a good time seeing the exhibition and perhaps having lunch, enough time to have lunch as well. I thought the discussions this morning were really interesting. I'm very much looking forward to our discussions in the panel after the tea break. For now, though, I'd just like to introduce Joy Gregory, the first speaker of this afternoon slot. Joy has been working in a wide range of areas. She's been particularly influenced by a combination of race, gender, and aesthetics. She attended the Royal College of Art, where she was awarded a Master in Photography in 1986 and has exhibited widely internationally, including in Cape Town, South Africa, where she first showed her series Lost Histories, reflecting on colonization and its effects on culture and self-image. Today, Joy will be talking largely about Cinderella Tours Europe, which is a series of photographs that grew out of numerous interviews Joy conducted during a research trip in the Caribbean, where she found that many of the people she spoke to really had a particular vision of Europe, where Europe was a place of unattainable dreams, almost a kind of an exotic other. And she then took the a pair of shoes, which she photographed around a different set of locations in Europe. And it's this this really lovely series of images which I think will form the cornerstone of Joy's presentation now.
Hello, thank you very much, Marco. Is that okay? Right, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here to present my work. I'm going to be talking to you as a practitioner because that's what I do. And I'm going to talk about a particular work which is called Cinderella Tours Europe and essentially how that work actually came about. The way in which I work is actually with stories. But initially when I began working as a photographer, I was very much drawn to still life, and I've dug up some really old photographs from like the very early 80s when I first started working with photography. Just to give you an idea of the background to my practice, I was very much studio-based and worked almost solely with objects, and it's something I tend to do an awful lot now because I find working with people within photography causes me to think. I have to think very deeply about doing it in terms of ethics sometimes as well, in terms of representing others. So I did all these like very Mirandi type influence type work, and then I started to photograph myself a bit, but very much on the outside of things. And working, I suppose, in a very painterly sort of way. So that's why I wanted to show you just an idea of how I used to work. In 1996, I won a commission as part of the European, sort of like one of those millennium things around photography, to go and make a work looking at the cultural connections between Europe and the Caribbean. And I took it upon myself just to pack my camera into my rucksack. So I got my Hasselblad out and just set off into the Caribbean. My parents are from Jamaica, so that was sort of like my idea of a starting point. But I actually didn't know anyone there or actually have any idea of any of those countries apart from what I'd been told by my own family or things that I'd read in books. Sort of like the same notion as other people might have of those particular places. And what I was looking for was whether or not there really was a connection between these two spaces, one of which actually came out, well, very closely connected through the triangle between Africa, the Americas, or the Caribbean, and Europe, and to get a sense of what the people there actually thought about Europe, but also what Europeans thought about the Caribbean. So it was a sort of like a two-sided thing. This is an interior from Haiti, and during the, from in Port-au-Prince. And at the time I went there, I had absolutely no idea what I was getting into at all, because it was at that time, it was in 97, and there wasn't actually a government. I'd never really been in a place without a government, and sort of it was a very strange place in which to be. And so, you know, that's me working as a photographer, but I always still do, to an extent, use these spaces almost as studios. So I photograph interiors, so I don't know if that's a studio or it's definitely not the street. And this is my street within the Caribbean. So I feel that my work actually falls in between those places. And I suppose what I did when I was in the Caribbean, this is in Guyana, was try to, I suppose, examine my own ideas about the Caribbean was, but also look for these senses, this sense of paradise, because it really, once you scratch beneath the surface, the paradise wasn't really there for many of the people that lived there. So I did a lot of landscapes, none of which I've really ever shown. I don't know, it has a particular aesthetic, which I think actually runs right the way through my work. So this is on the river that separates Guyana from Suriname. And I went with a group of... Because what I was doing was going out and collecting stories. That's the way in which I actually work. And photographs are sort of almost like incidental, the photographs I actually take on the way. And they're like my notes. And this is sort of going off to meet people who were the... who were the descendants of the Maroons, who were the runaway slaves. And so that was very much the focus of the work that I was doing in that particular country. The countries I visited were Jamaica, Cuba, Guyana, Venezuela, Panama, Haiti, obviously, and Suriname and Guyana. And when I came back to Europe, I went and photographed around different places that had those, you know, cities that had those connections with those particular places. And this is a shop window in Nantes. And what interested me there was how those things that we take for the everyday actually frame our idea of other cultures. And for me, you know, coming from the UK, it was a bit of a jolt seeing this doll or this figure in a shop window, whereas for everybody else in the street, it's like just part of the everyday landscape. And so I was actually interested in that, is how opinion is formed, like very subconsciously, just by things that we're surrounded with in the everyday. And the other part of the work that I did when I was, you know, when I was collecting stories, so people actually felt I was doing something other than just writing things down or recording things on a tape, because that's how I work, is I work using a sound recorder. So when I was working in the Caribbean at that time, I was using a DAT, so now I'd probably use a digital recorder of a different ilk. Was each of the people would expect to be photographed as well. So I actually did these portraits at the same time, but almost like a mechanism as a way of accessing those stories and getting people to relax around me so that they felt very at home. And I suppose my advantage of going often and photographing in these places is I looked an awful lot like them. And often when I go out into these spaces and I research, using the same, I suppose, methodologies that people have used before in terms of anthropology, is that, you know, you get people who are coming who are of other, from other places, from European spaces like I am, but they actually look European, they're white, and so people's response is very, very different. And that's, I mean, I'm working on another work at the moment out in the Kalahari, and that's been the response there, is that people don't actually see me as being a real researcher. I'm sort of like, you know, an errant daughter of a lost soul or something. I haven't even named all the people. this is Tracy. This is in Trinidad, and she worked at the theatre company out there. This is Elfrida Basuma, and she was the director of the National Gallery in Georgetown in Guyana. This is my next-door neighbour at that time, Deandra, and she was a schoolgirl living in Jamaica. And with each of the countries that I went to, and this is just an example, I collected stories from specific groups, mainly to do, I think, with people's idea of what that group actually did in like either France or in the UK or, you know, like in Spain. And because I knew Jamaica quite well, I ended, and also I thought one of the notions people have about Caribbean, or in particularly Jamaican society in this country, is around like single mothers and baby mothers and children and young girls having babies very early. So I went and interviewed over a period of a couple of weeks, and spent a lot of time with these young girls who were aged between 11 and 15, who'd actually had their first or second child. And what I did was I set the interviews up to ask them about, A, what they thought about where I came from, sort of like their imagined space of that, but also what dreams they had for themselves in the future and also for their children. And some of their descriptions of places in Europe actually became the basis for the work Cinderella Tours Europe. And it was something that I sort of like started to draw out from the work as I was going around. This is Sheena, and this is Sharla. And they were the two of the women that I spoke to, like 20 women, all young girls, in this mother and baby unit. Among the other people I actually met in the Caribbean, obviously in each country I've got different stories, was I met Christina and her mother, Indra. Because I think my idea of the Caribbean before I went was that, like, people had all come from Africa. Well, not all had come from Africa, but that was my notion, that people had were from Africa or from Europe, and I'd forgotten about all those spaces in between, or I wasn't really aware of them. And obviously, within the Caribbean, people come from all over the world, and it was something that I experienced when I was there. And they actually hold on to those cultures of, I suppose, places that they'd never ever been to, in the same way that my own parents held on to their idea of a culture in Jamaica, and I do in terms of a space that I actually don't know, but somewhere that I actually visit. And I met Christina through her brother, who was a missionary because I got deported from Suriname for having the wrong papers at some point, But he sort of like then challenged my idea of what missionary was, because my idea of a missionary was sort of like, you know, David Livingstone or something. You know, he just didn't actually fit the mold. And so I was having lots of my own prejudices and ideas about things actually challenged constantly during this journey. And it also helped in the development of many of the stories that I did. There's Mark with Christina and Indra in the field near their home. And this wasn't very far from Georgetown. And so, I mean, like, I think when I think about urban spaces, I think, you know, I think probably of big city spaces, but in a lot of the world, like, the capitals aren't like that. And the spaces very close by are sort of like very pastoral in this way. And this is another person that I met in Havana. There's a guy called Manuel Pina, who's quite a well-known photographer out there in Cuba. What was very interesting for me was, you know, I thought of Cuba as quite an idealized space at the time I first went there, or it was my first journey. But then I learned that of the racial prejudice that existed there, which is exactly the same as it had been within Jamaica, and they had this thing called shadism. I mean, not so much in Jamaica now, but it was something that was very apparent in the 50s, where unless you were of a very light skin, you would not be employed by a bank or in any official capacity. And the way that it works and still operates within the art world in Cuba is that you forget there's a very, very large black population there, and they're completely, you know, invisible in terms of what you see from the outside. But it's very interesting, because I work with another organisation and we invite artists to come over, and you ask people, you know, the artists that are quite established within that environment about, you know, are there any African or any black artists out there? Oh, no, there's none. And it's only when you go there do you actually discover that there's a whole other story? So, I mean, like it was, I mean, I found it a very educational journey, and I think that's why I decided to take it. When I came back and I decided to do the journey around Europe, and I had all these stories in my head, and I was also very worried about making a piece of work which was not to do with this work here. Well, it was, I mean, it was about this work here, about the research. It was called Memory and Skin, which ended up being an installation which looked at the people and the places within the Caribbean and that relationship historically through different texts and objects. But in the back of my mind, I was thinking about all these stories and what I could do with these stories. Or I don't know, I mean, I suppose I wasn't thinking I'm going to do this with these stories, because a lot of my work doesn't, I mean, I don't determine how it develops itself. And when I was in Panama, I bought this pair of gold shoes. I don't know why I bought a pair of gold shoes, but I just did. And I took them with me. Back, you know, on my journey back. So the journey, because it's communications are very difficult within the Caribbean, and so I ended up I flew from Haiti back to Guyana, and then to Panama, and then from Panama to Havana, and then from Havana back to London, because that was my route back home. And each place I went to, and I showed them these shoes that I'd bought, and said, oh, what do you think of these? And like, everybody wanted to keep them, and I thought, oh no, you can't have them, I'm taking them back with me. And then when I got back to London, I think I was a bit mad by then, having been away for quite a long time, I stayed in London for 2 weeks, I think, or 10 days, and then I started my epic journey around Europe to ask exactly the same questions of people that I met on the way about their idea of the Caribbean. And I took these shoes with me, and occasionally I would take them out and I'd take a picture of them, but they're almost like my friends. I thought, because I'd been away for such a long time, I'd actually lost all my friends. So I hadn't really lost them. I thought that I had, and I never really saw anyone. So they were like my companion. And I mean, obviously I was following these historical routes around these different cities within Europe. And in Spain, I went to Cadiz because of its association with Columbus and that journey out to Hispaniola. And so I photographed the shoes in the harbour of Cadiz, and I didn't really think anything of it. And then when I came back to London, I thought, well, it's quite a nice project. I'll start photographing the shoes in all the places that I go to. So I photographed them in Docklands. I was thinking, when someone was saying about sort of like, you can't really photograph in Canary Wharf anymore. And I think in a way that dates these photographs. So the idea of like, you know, putting something down in the street and going across to the other side and photographing it, I mean, it wouldn't really be there very long nowadays. So this is like pre-9/11. I can't imagine doing that there. So I wasn't really consciously thinking about what these shoes were about, but I was subconsciously thinking about that they had a very close relationship with the other work that I was developing. And this is in, God, I can't remember where it is now, in Spain. Oh, God, it'll come to me in a minute. Seville, it's in Seville. And after I'd done these, I showed them to someone, and they said, this is a really good project, you should actually follow this up and think about it and carry it through properly. And so I got some money to actually make the work, and I'd actually had time to think about it a bit more, and how the shoes themselves actually, for me, embodied the stories of the people that I saw. And like, I remember that those young girls in that, one of the young women that I'd spoke to in Jamaica, said, talking about she'd really love to go to that place where they have water for roads, you know, sort of like the roads are made of water. And it was just like incredibly poetic. And you think, well, you know, it's probably been out of school, you know, went to school for like 3 years and spent most of the time fighting in the streets. And like she knows about this place. And that was what was really interesting, was how much more people knew about, the people in the Caribbean knew about Europe. And those places, than the people from Europe actually knew about the different cities and places within the Caribbean. And for me, it was really interesting that. And then, so I thought I'd start off by going to Granada. I don't know why. And I decided, and I'm not a person that photographs in the street. I really am happy in the studio, and with, because I don't like people looking at me. And I always think, if you're taking pictures in the street, people will look at you, even if you imagine they're looking at you. And I decided to, this is my first picture that I'd done as part of the commission, which it's not actually in any of the series. But what I decided to do was, there's the picture of Columbus with Queen Isabella in Granada. And I thought, well, I really want to put the shoes next to that because that's the beginning of the whole story. So I put the shoes next to this monument and I went across the road to photograph. And I did it really early in the morning. I went out at 5 because I didn't want anyone to see me. And I'd sort of like put the camera down, set the camera up and put the shoes out on the thing. And I was just getting everything in focus. And then suddenly the shoes disappeared. And it was because somebody, some soul who thought, you know, like who was sleeping in the street, thought those look nice and they're mine. So we had a huge argument about whether or not they were my shoes or her shoes or whatever. You know, so I managed to hold on to them. I gave her some money or something. But so that was the beginning of the journey. And then what I decided I wanted to do was to do it not like I'd done with the first one, but to take, I suppose, the genre of the postcard, the picture postcard, and I suppose sort of like iconic images of places that exist in people's minds but may not actually really exist in reality. And I think this is a case in point. So I thought, well, I wanted to take a picture in Holland that looks like it's from Holland, and I had real problems trying to find windmills like that. And the positioning of the shoes within that, sort of like a, I don't know, sort of, it was all about how they fitted together aesthetically, but also within the meaning of them. And so that they're like bigger, the shoes are bigger than the actual windmills. I talked about Venice with the young woman who wanted to go to the city which was made of water. And so it's like, and so I found this bridge which is called the Bridge of Miracles and placed the shoes there. So each of the sites that I chose had a particular resonance to the stories that I was told. I suppose the other thing was the way in which I did do organise photographs. So sometimes I'd be in a place for quite a long time, so I'd be there for like, I don't know, a couple of days or 3 days or something. But sometimes I'd only have a couple of hours, and so I worked an awful lot with maps and sort of like other picture postcards to sort out what would be the best view. And it was sort of like that Kodak thing, sort of like this is the best spot from which to get the photograph, which says a lot about that particular place, even if it's in a very mythical way. And this is St. Paul's, not St. Paul's, St. Mark's Square in Venice. And this is like one of my favourites from the series. And it's because it's an accident as well, because like it was a very long exposure and I hadn't actually done the tripod up properly. And I hadn't, but very slowly because of the weight of the camera and the lightness of the tripod, they sort of like moved to one side and eventually ended up on its side. And I quite like what it actually did within that idea of chance. In Haiti, I stayed on the street with some street children, and they had this particular notion of Paris and the Eiffel Tower. So I had this iconic view of the Eiffel Tower with the shoes as well. In Suriname, when I went into the interior, the people that were working out there had a lot of connections with the UN and with the Red Cross, and so I photographed these shoes in Geneva in front of the Red Cross building. So some of them are obvious, the places, and some of them not so obvious, but they all had a resonance from the stories and the people that I actually met. I don't know if this is the last one, but this one I quite like. This is in Lisbon. And this was probably one of the last ones I actually took, because I went to Lisbon, I flew to Lisbon on the 9th of September 2001, and I had no idea what was going on at all. I think till about 2 days later, because I didn't really understand. I just like was going off and just doing my work. But this was a Vasco da Gama sort of like going out on his voyage of discovery, and this tiny picture of these two shoes were like creeping back in from the West world. And you know, there were other stories like in the Olympic Stadium in Berlin. So it's to do with sort of like the Olympics that happened in 1936 and the stories that existed around that. And this is how the exhibition was. So they're like, they're not postcard size, they're quite big. They're like a metre by a metre images of these shoes. So the shoes become very big within the space. And it became quite a popular project. So eventually, I mean, I was invited to show it in Spain and they produce a little catalogue of the work, which is actually in three languages. So that's my work. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Jo. That was really interesting. The next speaker this afternoon is Stephen Bull. Stephen Bull is an artist, writer, curator, and lecturer. I first came across his work actually just after I'd started here at Tate in 2006, when Stephen was putting the finishing touches to his collection of books on meeting Hazel Stokes. And the story of that book seemed so interesting and also just charmed to me, the notion of a cinema usherette who has her picture taken with all the celebrities who come to her cinema, and to publish that as a book. That I've just been intrigued by Steve's work ever since. And I think today Stephen is going to talk to us a little bit more generally about the notions of celebrity in photography.
Thanks, Marcus. Yes, I should say, just before I start, I'm not speaking in my capacity as a practitioner today. Probably more the lecturer, writer side of me is speaking today, but hopefully some of you went to the How We Are show at Tate Britain a little while back and saw the show there, and meeting Hazel Stokes, that series was in there, so I'm not going to show that today. Luke to win? Or could it be Cat? Maybe it's Mohammed? You never know. It could be Lisa, bit of a wild card, but it could be. It won't be Jennifer, as of last night. But it could be someone we've only just met, like Sarah, Belinda, or May Soon. If you don't recognise these faces and these names, you probably haven't been watching the latest series of Big Brother. If you have, and I hope some of you have, if you have, then you'll be familiar with the strange intimacy the series creates with viewers at home, as we watch the people in the Big Brother house. These photographs that I'm showing here, these are taken in a studio. Apparently, these are taken, I think I'm right in saying, during the auditions for the series. And you can actually see the videos of their auditions on the Channel 4 Big Brother website as well. But in these pictures, the wannabe housemates for Big Brother are posing for the camera in front of this almost ubiquitous white backdrop that you see in so many studio images. And at the end of the street and studio exhibition, which I guess hopefully now everyone has seen most if not all of it, at the very end of the street and studio exhibition, we see a similar kind of idea of the studio or the white background in Rinneker Dykstra's images of Clubbers. But these also bring to mind Andy Warhol's screen tests. And this is something which Michael Bracewell mentions in the catalogue for Street and Studio. Some of you hopefully have had a chance to read some of the catalogue essays. Michael Bracewell mentions Andy Warhol's screen tests. What happened with Andy Warhol's screen tests? These were films that he made in the 1960s. Basically, he set the camera up, a video or film camera, in the factory, in his studio, the factory in the 1960s. And anyone that came to the factory was just filmed in front of this fixed camera, just doing basically whatever they wanted to do, which sometimes was nothing, in front of this fixed camera for 20 minutes, half an hour or so. So it's a very sort of familiar kind of style in a way from Warhol's screen tests. More of Warhol later, inevitably. Another type of Big Brother photograph is this kind. This is a still grabbed from the events that take place in the Big Brother house. And obviously, you know, the house is another kind of studio, really. In some ways, the Big Brother house is a television studio. But also, these images that are grabbed from the recordings, they have a sort of feeling of the spontaneity of street photography about them. I don't know if David Bate is still here, but he asked a question about authenticity earlier on. David Bate has pointed out how these stills grabbed from the moving image, usually, you know, digitally grabbed from the moving image, are really an equivalent these days to a decisive moment. But in this case, it's a decisive moment that's been caught with careful editing after the event. And there is, you know, there is an element of the decisive moment in street photography here. This, particularly in this one, I think, you know, this is almost like a sort of Robert Duano sort of, you know, image capturing the kiss, you know, although, of course, as we now know, that Duano image was very, very staged, but then maybe some of the actions in Big Brother are quite staged as well. We're not just in the age of mass reproduction, and I'm including digital mass reproduction amongst that. We're also in an age of mass celebrity. We're in an age where the desire for fame is widespread in Western culture. This isn't fame or celebrity through long-term achievement, you know, finally gaining fame through achievement, but really what people are after, generally speaking, is a very instant kind of celebrity, you know, a fast track to fame. This is what people seem to be after. Again, at the very end of the Street and Studio show, just before you get to the doors, the exit doors at the show, you get a series of Jürgen Teller's go-sees, his go-sees photographs. And in a way, these images sort of suggest this culture of instant fast-track to fame. We've got images here of wannabe supermodels standing on the threshold to fame, or the threshold to potential fame anyway. These are the people that turn up at Jürgen Teller's studio basically hoping to be photographed by him and sort of, you know, break through and have a career in modelling. And so there they are, you know, standing literally on the threshold there, someone trying to sneak in on the picture on the right there, just getting the hand over the threshold there. And of course we see this on the guide and the catalogue that goes with the show as well. There's another image there, someone literally, you know, on that, and this is of course why it's been picked, literally on that border between the street and the studio. But it's also something a little bit reminiscent of people on television talent shows, you know, sort of standing there nervously waiting for the stern but expert opinions of the judges. Or maybe they're standing there at the entrance doors to the Big Brother house. In the age of mass celebrity, there's an idea that we can all achieve fame. You know, there's an idea that everyone is a potential star. And you know, in a way, we just need to be seen in enough images to gain fame. But it wasn't always so. This idea hasn't really been around, you know, for that long. From around about the 1920s up to around about the 1960s, this is an era that I'm calling the golden age of celebrity. There was a very clear distinction between who was a celebrity and who was not. So in the exhibition, we have some of Walker Evans' 1946 series of passers-by. These are in the show. This is actually two pages from when they were published in Fortune magazine in 1946. And in those images, we see people on the streets of Detroit, and they're going to work. And Walker Evans has basically had pretty much a fixed camera and photographed them from the same angle each time. I mean, the important thing about this isn't to show all these people and say, you know, all these people are potential celebrities, which kind of might be the take that we might sort of have on it now. You know, hey, these people are all individuals and they're all kind of stars in their own way. You know, that's not really the take that these images have in the 1946 version. In Walker Evans' original text, which wasn't used in the magazine itself at the time, but it's quoted in the exhibition, Walker Evans called these photographs a cross-section view of average, hard-working people. And you know, it's called Labour Anonymous. So, you know, this isn't about showing people as celebrities. You know, this is just showing these people as these are average people. These are everyday people. By contrast, during the same era, celebrities, the famous people of the time, are almost always shown as deities, really, as gods and goddesses who are sort of way above us, just to be worshipped by us mere mortals. And photography helped that kind of celebrity to be achieved. And we see quite a few examples of that in the show. And it's, you know, it's generally speaking, it's studio photographs that are used to make these celebrities seem so magnificent and godlike. So very elaborately staged and retouched images. So this is Arturo Gergo, I think it's pronounced. And this is his photograph of the Italian actress Isa Miranda. In the catalogue, it's described as an ethereal image. And there's certainly this kind of flattering glow around the image that we see. It's very much kind of, you know, showing someone as almost heavenly and ethereal. And of course, in Madame Yvonne's amazing colour pictures of the 1930s, where she shows society women of the time as goddesses, you know, you've got a great example here of, literally showing these people as deities. This is Lady Bridget, I think, Poulet, photographed as Arethusa from 1935. So literally showing them as goddesses in this series. And of course, there's... We've seen this one briefly earlier on today as well. Cecil Beaton's photograph of his sister, Nancy, here, actually as a star, as a shooting star. So literally as a star in this image. And it's a slightly more pixelated version of a much better quality image. We saw a much better quality version of this earlier on, but you've seen the even better quality version in the show as well, I hope. This is Philip Hulsman, one of his jumping photographs from the 1950s, where he got famous people to jump in front of the camera. And actually, you know, in the catalogue, it talks about them being sort of caught at an off-guard moment. But I'm not so sure, really. I think when you look at a lot of these jumping photographs, you know, you've got Marilyn Monroe, you've got Ouija, celebrity photographer, Ouija, and here, Grace Kelly. I think they're still very aware of the camera, you know, even as they are there in midair. You know, so they're very aware of kind of, you know, posing, performing, even though they're in midair. But these stars were about to be brought down to earth. The big bang for paparazzi photography happened on the night of the 14th of August, 1958, in Rome. Over the course of that night, you get a number of Italian photographers catching various Italian actors and actresses, American actors and actresses, people like Ava Gardner, some politicians as well. All of these people are sort of caught by photographers in compromising positions in the streets of Rome. They're caught with various married people, but not the people they're married to. And so the photographers, over the course of this one night, seem to catch all these people out in these pictures. This is a photograph taken from that night by Elio Scorci, which shows the photographer Tazio Securoli being assaulted by the actor and former boxer Walter Chiari. Not a good idea, really, to anger a former boxer. Chiari was out on the town with the married actress Anita Ekberg, and I stress he wasn't married to her. So he's out on the town with Anita Ekberg. And so, as you can see, you know, there's a bit of a scuffle going on with the photographer. Within days, these pictures were on every street. They were on the pages of newspapers and on the pages of magazines. And as Jeremy Miller, in his catalogue text, reminds us, 2 years later, the Italian director Federico Fellini made the film La Dolce Vita. And in La Dolce Vita, you see various photographers on scooters in Rome chasing celebrities around, including an actress who's played by Anita Ekberg herself. There she is. So it's very much a film which is kind of based on those events in Rome and things that happened afterwards as well. And one of the photographers, one of these photographers whizzing around on scooters photographing these famous people, one of the photographers, who's actually based on Secchiaroli, who we saw the photograph by just now, one of the photographers is named Paparazzo, and which means very broadly, and I seem to get different opinions on this, but very broadly means mosquito. And this is almost certainly where the phrase paparazzi, the plural form of paparazzo, comes from. So, basically the idea of the paparazzi suggests like a group of annoying, buzzing mosquitoes. And so from this point on, the photographing of celebrities became as much about catching them off guard in the street as it did making them look good in the studio. Now, there are a few exceptions to this, but I'm talking about the sort of general trend in what happened in photography. So about as much about catching them off guard in the street as it did making them look good in the studio. In the 1970s and 1980s, the art of the paparazzi was refined by photographers, including, and we saw this image briefly earlier on, the New York-based photographer Ron Galella. There's a couple of examples of his photographs in the Street and Studio exhibition. This is one of them. As was mentioned earlier on, Ron Galella really was still around and was the most famous American paparazzi photographer, and really was perhaps the first, as Bettina mentioned earlier on, in America. So this is one of his images. This is Woody Allen and Mia Farrow in 1980, and it really does look as though a mosquito has got into the car, and is kind of buzzing around them, but quite clearly they do not want to be photographed, and are hiding from the camera. Karen E. Becker has identified the main characteristics of paparazzi photographs. She describes them as being badly composed and partly out of focus, often including intrusive foreground objects, and catching strange facial expressions and poses. Generally speaking, paparazzi photographs will have one or more of these characteristics, and certainly the other photograph in the show has got an example of that as well, the Mick Jagger, Jerry Hall photograph. If you put all these elements of the sort of, in a way, kind of like bad photography elements of the paparazzi photograph together, what Karen E. Becker argues is that they create the impression of an unstaged and a truthful picture that reveals what the celebrity is really like. And also, paparazzi photographs, they often show their subjects in everyday situations. Ron Galella was Andy Warhol's favourite photographer. And this is hardly surprising, especially if you bear in mind that Andy Warhol said his idea of a good photograph was of a famous person doing something unfamous. He also said it's being in the right place at the wrong time. So you can kind of see why he might have liked the American sort of king of paparazzi photography. Now, Warhol, of course, is very associated with fame. This is an image which is in the show, but not quite in this form. I'll come to it in a second. In the 1960s, he made quote-unquote superstars of the people who hung out at the factory, at his studio, the factory. And he made them superstars partly through making films that they were in, but also they were photographed by the right people at the right time. And this is, as I say, a version of... It's a much smaller version in the exhibition, but this is a sort of triple photograph, a triptych of sorts, I guess, by Richard Avedon, taken in 1969. So, the right photographer in the right place, really, to photograph these superstars. Warhol himself is at the very far right of the image, and you can spot him in the show if you can't quite make him out there. And it's that studio with the white background again. There it is. It's ubiquitous. So the 1960s, really, you sort of begin this sort of post-Warhol era of celebrity. And it's a very double-sided sort of version of celebrity. You know, you get famous people being shown to be ordinary people, just like us. But at the same time, there's an idea that ordinary people, everyone and anyone, can be famous, can be a celebrity. Yeah, for 15 minutes at least, we all know the quote. Although originally it was world famous, but that's kind of been watered down over the years. So how is it that everyone can be famous? You know, how is it that this fast track to brief fame, 15 minutes, you know, can be achieved? Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier on, by appearing really in as many images as possible, as often as possible, that really helps, you know, fame by mass reproduction. Do you remember these? Yeah, oh, some, you remember them? Oh, great, fantastic. I was going to say, it's not a rhetorical question, but it could almost be. Now, this is Stuart and Michelle, as you can tell by the text there. And they became a couple in Big Brother in 2004. And this is a photograph taken in a studio shortly after they came out of the house. And you'll notice there the text, "All the pictures the world has waited to see." So maybe it is. Maybe it is world famous, actually. So we've got these kind of flattering pictures of people looking okay. They still continue. Hello Magazine is another one where you get a lot of these. But also, of course, then there's these other magazines like Heat Magazine and Star Magazine as well. We'll see in a minute. Lots of other ones as well. And these are where they use paparazzi pictures, you know, taken on the streets. And they do all sorts of things to manipulate the photographs to make people look bad. And they're very much used to show the flaws of celebrities. And, you know, it's always to do with their bodies. You know, it's always to do with parts of their bodies. You know, Britney's scar, you know, Uma's big hands, and, Emma's large forehead, and, guess who with that finger, which is, it's Denzel Washington, just to put you out of your misery. It's photography, it's all photographic tricks, you know. Obviously, just the same way that the flattering pictures use photographic techniques, so do these non-flattering ones as well. But you'll notice that all the flaws are to do with the body. You know, hey, no body is perfect. And Chris Rojek, in his book Celebrity, he talks about how there is an idea of making stars, making celebrities human. You know, and very often this is done through a process that he calls mortification. You know, so it's making the gods and goddesses mortal, showing that they are only human, like the rest of us. In fact, here's Star Magazine with sweaty celebrities. 15 mortifying pictures inside. You know, it's like they've read Chris Rojek and they're putting theory into practice. If celebrities are only human like us, maybe we can be celebrities like them. You know, this is quite a in a way this is quite liberating. This, you know, we could be famous. You know, if in order to be famous you have to be a deity, well, we're not going to achieve it. But if celebrities are shown to be only human like us, maybe we can do it as well. And of course the latest example of this would be Amy Winehouse. And you know, very often these bodily quote-unquote flaws are used to sort of suggest, you know, sort of what's going on inside. You know, so this is very often the way. We've sort of seen this relentless hounding down of Amy Winehouse whenever she walks out into the street, and even in her own house, actually. We have pictures taken of her constantly in the street, sometimes on mobile phone cameras and digital cameras, and very often these images appear on websites within hours and in newspapers and magazines the next day. It's pretty grim stuff. So there's certainly, you know, these examples of showing the physical flaws of celebrities continues. But also, the fan worship hasn't gone away. Scott Thorne and Gordon Bruner, they've defined a fan. They define a fan as possessing, there's just a few examples here, possessing involvement with the objects of their interest and adjusting their lifestyle to accommodate it. Okay. these objects could be photographs, a desire to demonstrate their interest to other people, and a wish to acquire objects related to their interest. So we could talk about the desire to acquire photographs of famous people in their physical form as objects. This image here is an example of someone with photographs in their physical form. It's actually an image taken from a film. Some of you might recognise the film, Bend It Like Beckham, directed by Gurinder Chadha, and it came out in 2001. And so here we have Jess in the film, and she's a sort of wannabe footballer, an aspiring footballer, and her hero is David Beckham, as you probably spotted. And so, you know, she's sort of Beckham obsessed, and she's got this shrine to Beckham in her bedroom here. So, you know, actually within the room itself, she's got the shrine here. The character of Jess is played by Parminder Nagra. Some of you might see where I'm going with this. So actually, the photographs that she's got on the walls there, and you see them in the film quite often as well, they're a combination of photographs taken in the street and combined with photographs taken in the studio, as well as on the pitch as well, actually. And in fact, there's just in the corner there, there's a newspaper clipping which refers to Beckham and the rest of the England team as Greek gods. Mind you, I haven't seen that kind of headline for a little while. Even since this film came out in 2001, things have changed rather a lot with photography, and we've touched upon it a bit already. You know, these days, fan images are more likely to be digitally downloaded pictures from the many, you know, sort of Beckham fan sites. You know, if you wanted to, you know, Beckham pictures, you digitally download them. You wouldn't necessarily get them from a magazine or a newspaper, for example. So David Beckham fans online, and so you've got examples here, you know, out and about. You've got the sort of photographs of Beckham, you can see one there, sort of lower left kind of thing, you know, photographed in the street, so you've got those kind of photographs, but you can also get your studio photographs as well, images from magazine shoots taken in the studio. You know, you can download them, put them as wallpaper on your, you know, screensavers, stick them on your mobile phone, you know, or whatever, you know, carry them around with you. You know, so, you know, there's actually this, you know, you might have them on Facebook as your avatar or something like that. You know, there's very much a sort of different experience digitally with these images. In fact, there's an intimacy about the images that we view and see on our screens. You know, you could argue that, you know, the way that these images appear directly in our home, as if they're just for us to see on our computer screen. You know, even though they might appear and disappear from one screen to another, you know, they sort of feel as though at that moment they're there just for us to see. But it's a very strange thing about the digital photograph, you know, which is kind of very often here and then it's gone. You know, the digital photograph is everywhere and it's nowhere at the same time. It's a very curious phenomenon. But, you know, it does kind of feel as though these images are just for us. So Parminder Nagra has gone on to become a celebrity herself. And she's got plenty of fan websites dedicated to her. She's now in ER, I believe. I don't watch ER myself, actually. That one, I can't watch the medical ones, but apparently she's in that and doing very well. So, you know, if you look on YouTube, lots of interviews on American chat shows and so on. She's doing very well. She's, you know, she is a celebrity in her own right. And so, as I say, there are websites dedicated to her where you can download images or view images such as this one. And so this one is a flattering studio portrait of Parminder Nagra. And this is the same image that Christoffer Bjørnson has downloaded and used as part of his series Mindy, My Indian Flower, which is on show in the Street and Studio exhibition. In fact, the title of this is My Indian Flower 0803_observer3_LG, which is its file name. And so what he's done is he's downloaded the image, and here he's made it into 90 inkjet prints, and presented them as if they're pinned to the wall, you know, rather like those pictures of Beckham, you know, in the bedroom were pinned to the wall. And the same thing with the Natalie Portman image here. I don't think this pinning them to the wall is a sort of, you know, Tillman-style arty use of pins. I think this is more a reference to pin-ups, as I say, like we saw in the bedroom. And what's interesting about this is, you know, he's downloaded these images. Here you can see, by the way, here's an example of where he's, you know, he's printed all onto the separate inkjet prints. It's interesting that he's printed them again. You know, we're not just seeing this. You know, he could have projected this, or he could have shown this on a screen. And, you know, there are projections and screens in the show, and that's very often how we encounter photographs these days. But he's actually printed them out, and it suggests the need for physical prints. And, you know, there's a famous piece of writing by Christian Metz called Photography and Fetish, where he suggests that the photograph is a very good example of a fetish object, something that stands in for an absent desired person, basically, or another object, perhaps. And the important thing about it is that it can be carried around, you know, it's portable, and crucially as well, it can be touched, you know, it is a physical object that can be touched. And Bjornson's pictures kind of fit this description, really, of the photographer's fetish. So, you know, Bjornson's pictures, they could be carried around and reassembled anywhere, and, you know, I'm told this is how they arrived at the gallery in sort of A4 size boxes, and then they're reassembled. A bit like, you know, sort of Gilbert and George kind of technique, you know. So they can be carried around and assembled anywhere. As I say, as well as Natalie Portman, as well as Pamina Nagra, there's an image of Natalie Portman. Now, I've not really been able to find out exactly where this one is from, but I think this is more of a, you know, a sort of fan photograph taken in the street, or perhaps a paparazzi photograph taken in the street. It's certainly not a studio photograph, unless they've faked it very well to look like it's taken in the street. So you've got both variations there within a single piece of work by Bjornson. But there's also, these images are larger than life, as you can see here. You know, these images are very, very big. In fact, I think... And I sort of checked as much as I can. The biggest image is in the show, but the curator might tell me otherwise. But I think they're the biggest images in the show. And Bjornson has whole exhibitions of images of Pamina Nagra and Natalie Portman as well. And there we go. There's one of them. Now, why is there something a bit spooky about this? You know, I found myself standing in front of the work, looking at it, and being very interested by it. But it's a bit, something slightly creepy. You know, there's something a little bit spooky about it, especially when you see these whole shows dedicated to them. And the series as a whole is called My Girls, and, you know, as the text in the show talks about, there's a sort of suggestion of an imaginary relationship with the people in the pictures. You know, through the photographs, there's a kind of imaginary relationship that's developed, and it reminded me of a film which I suspect probably quite a few people here have seen, 1 Hour Photo, directed by Mark Romanek, I think I'm right in saying, which came out, I think, maybe about 3 or 4 years back now, I think, something like that. And 1 Hour Photo has got Robin Williams there as a lab technician, and he prints photographs for all sorts of people, including a family who he sees as an ideal family. You know, he sees them as the perfect family. And because he comes from a background, his family background was less than ideal, he sort of imagines himself as part of that family. There's one of their snaps there. This is sort of, you know, a staged snapshot for the film. So whenever he prints their images, he also prints up a set for himself as well, which he then takes home with him. And I apologise for the bad quality of these images, but he then covers a whole wall in his apartment with these family snapshots. Sorry about the bad quality, but there he is sitting in his apartment with this wall of snapshots assembled behind him. In fact, there's one point where he sees, they're called the Yorkin family, and there's one point where he sees one of the people in the family in the shop that he works in, and he's never seen him before, and it's like he's met a celebrity, and he sort of goes up to him and goes, "You're Will Yorkin." You know, and it's like when you meet a famous person, you know, because they become celebrities to him. Anyway, you know, This is when you see this scene in the film, and I apologise if you haven't seen the film yet, but you've had a few years to see it, you know. But when you get to this scene in the film, this is quite a, you know, this is a disturbing moment when you realise that he's got this imaginary relationship with this family through the photographs. So, although Bjornson's pictures are here in a gallery, They are also reminiscent of the domestic environment of an obsessive fan. And I think we're perhaps culturally we're increasingly wary of such obsessions, although there's a lot of them about. But it also suggests an important aspect of the photographs in the show. There's a very important aspect of the photographs in the show which Street and Studio only really hints at. It's a big show, it can't do everything. You know, it's covering a lot of things, it can't do everything, but it only hints at this, which is that the Street and Studio are the spaces where these images are made or produced. You know, the Street and Studio is where these images are made. And Street and Studio is an urban history of photography in a gallery space. But what I want to suggest is that there's another place where images are consumed, you know, not just the gallery. And it's a vital aspect of all these photographs, really, that we've seen. And that's that they travel from the street or the studio, not just to the space of the gallery, but also to our homes as well. And so, you know, when we look at the website of Street and Studio, when we buy the catalogue, when we purchase a postcard, when we take home that Steichen fridge magnet, we're actually, you know, we're taking these images to part of a whole other, more intimate space and a more intimate history. And really what these images suggest is another history of photography, a domestic history of photography. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Stephen. We've now got a half-hour tea break in the auditorium foyer next door, so I look forward to seeing you back here at 2:15.